Let us talk now, though, to Scott Lucas, a friend of Talk Radio, very much a man who I've had one or two crossed swords with over time. But today, it's homeschooling time, so we're not going to have a row. We're just going to talk about the facts of the matter, because I thought what a good plan it would be to get everybody to understand how the American election system works, because it's very different from ours. They have an electoral college system. And Scott, who is, of course, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham, is going to tell us exactly how it works. So collect your children, gather them around the old radio, get them around the TV if you're watching on YouTube, and we will educate you. Scott, a very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Thank you.
I'm still trying to understand it myself, but we'll give it a go.
Well, listen, I'm sure there are plenty of people who would argue that there are some people who take advantage of it in some ways or not. We're not going to go anywhere near the whether it should be taking place in November or not. But it's basically about the fact that the main difference in your system in America than ours is that the number of votes cast actually doesn't matter.
Well, Mike, in a way, they're similar. Let me explain, because I think what you're talking about is that in America, you have this curiosity, goes back to the 18th century, called the Electoral College.
Right.
Now, that is a number of delegates from each state who are chosen by the voters in November's election, and they then cast their electors' ballot up in Washington, D.C. So in other words, the popular vote doesn't decide who the president is. It's those 55 electors from California, or those three from Alaska, or there's 10 or 11 from Alabama. Mm. You put all of that together. But the easiest way for me to try to understand this is that you kind of have the same system in the United Kingdom. You just call it an electoral college. And that is, when you choose your head of government, he's actually chosen by 650 members of parliament.
Right.
And they, of course, are elected in 650 constituencies. Sort of 650 little mini states, if you will. And remember that in the UK, that's a winner take all. Mm. If you get 51% of the vote in your constituency, or even 33%, but more than anybody else, you've won. So in the United States, in each of these states, it's a winner take all thing. If the largest state, California, goes 51-49 for Joe Biden over Donald Trump, or vice versa, that person gets all the delegates. And that works all the way through each of the states, where you get this curiosity in America that from 1876 to 2000, the person who won the popular vote also won the Electoral College and became president. But in 2000, Al Gore won the most votes. It was George W. Bush who narrowly won the Electoral College after a dispute over those Florida votes, you might remember.
Yeah.
And then the second time in history that happened, where someone lost the popular vote but won the Electoral College, Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Right. And so, I mean, given that that has happened twice relatively recently, mm-hmm. is there any pressure, for example, on the system to make it different, to make it more, I suppose, even-handed, so that if more people do vote for one particular candidate, that that candidate ends up as the winner?
Oh, there's recurrent movements that talk about the idea that this should be a popular vote. But of course, the problem with going to a popular vote now is that you could be the party that's disadvantaged by it. So it just so happens that the way the electoral map is set up right now, the Democrats win big. I mean, they win by 15-20% in the largest states, in New York and in California. So they pile up millions of votes in leads in the big states. And then the Republicans, as in 2016, have won narrowly in states that are smaller than New York and California, say like Wisconsin, say like even Michigan, or say like a place like Missouri. And so the result is that even though Hillary Clinton piled up a 3 million popular vote advantage over Donald Trump on the East and West Coast, Trump won the presidency because of 80,000 votes that swung the other way towards him in what's called the swing states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So,
and I think Ohio as well. Was Ohio not
one
as well?
So the Republicans, in other words, right now, it's really not in their interest. And I'm not playing party politics, it's just pragmatic politics. It's not in their interest to go to a popular vote right now, because they're the ones who happen to be benefiting from those narrow wins in the key swing states.
Right. And are they called swing states because they literally swing from one side to the other, that they can't always be counted? I mean, California can always be counted as a Democrat blue state, as can New York, I guess. But Ohio and Wisconsin, as you said, Pennsylvania, they change.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Mike. In a, quote, normal election,
yeah.
This one isn't normal, we can talk about that, but in a normal election, you can call about 40 of the 50 states months before the vote is held. It's those 10 states, and again, we're talking about Midwest states, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. You talk about it, Florida, huge, had decided the election in 2000. You talk about possibly, for example, a state like Missouri or a state like North Carolina. Those are the ones that we focus on because they usually are within about 1% to 2% for one candidate or the other.
Mm. It's interesting, really, isn't it? Because the campaigning that goes on in those states often defines who actually ends up winning. And famously, I think Hillary didn't really pay much attention to Ohio and Wisconsin, and therefore, as a result, kind of lost them. They were kind of known as the Rust Belt, weren't they, for Donald Trump. But as far as the demographics go, does that change the way that these states operate in terms of who they vote for, or is it more about the personality?
It works on all of these, Mike, but to start from this, what you're talking about is in some of the swing states, you're talking about, for example, voters who have tended to be classified as in the center, but relatively conservative in their viewpoints. A lot of them have worked in traditional manufacturing industries, so you call them the Rust Belt. Mm. So when the American economy turns down, they tend to vote for the opponent. They voted for Barack Obama in 2009. They voted for Donald Trump narrowly in 2016. But in other swing states, it's the diversity of the population that matters. Rather than being red Republican states or blue Democrat, they become purple because they have a variety of population, white, Hispanic, African-American, and because it's not just all working class or all upper class. And states that are problematic for the Republicans, that are changing because of that, that have usually been Republican but may not be this year, include Arizona, Georgia, and importantly, Texas.
And will it change things depending on who Biden decides to pick as his running mate? Because a lot of talk that he's more than likely to pick a woman as his running mate. I'm assuming that probably will be the case. But does he gain anything in terms of any of those swing states as a result of that?
I think you can always get a marginal boost for your vice presidential choice. And it will be a woman. Joe Biden has said that. It quite probably will be a woman of color. Think about an African-American like Kamala Harris, Karen Bass, Val Demings. But I think it's only marginal, Mike. As much as we pay attention to the vice presidential choice, it's the big issues that sort of decide elections. Bill Clinton's people in the 1990s famously said, it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah.
But of course, on top of the economy this year, which is in a very difficult state, we've got the pandemic, which is likely to still be raging by November. And we've also got the issues that have raised by the anti-racism marches across the U.S. since May.
Yeah. And interestingly as well, for people listening on this side of the Atlantic, there's no cap, is there, as far as I'm aware, on the amount of money you can spend on campaign contributions and on campaign advertising, whereas in this country, obviously, there is.
There was an attempt to limit it, Mike, in the start of the 21st century with campaign finance reform. But what that reform did is it limited what you call hard money. And hard money is money that's given directly to the campaign of, say, a Donald Trump or a Joe Biden, and you would identify whether that came from a business, whether it came from an activist group like the National Rifle Association. But what happened on all sides, Republican, Democrat, is they started to turn towards soft money. They would create these groups called political action committees, now known as PACs or super PACs.
Right.
And those PACs are not under the same regulations. So they don't have the same limits on how much they can spend. And also because they technically say that they are not part of the campaign, they don't have the same restrictions on what they can say under the Federal Election Commission's rules.
So they literally can spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
And will do so.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing to watch this year has been that the spending balance tended to favor Donald Trump through these PACs up until June and July. But in the last 2 months, Biden has overtaken him in spending through both hard and soft money.
Yeah. Fascinating times. Well, November is going to be very interesting indeed. I'm assuming that the race will go ahead and the election will go ahead there. Thank you very much indeed. Scott Lucas there, Professor of International Politics, who's over at University of Birmingham, a man who knows a thing or two about the way the electoral system works in the US of A.